Welcome to Season 6 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 127, Super Snipers. Today we are joined by Galen McCown of Galen's Games. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. Before we jump into your game, tell me a little about yourself and what got you into designing games.
I live in Syracuse, New York. I'm a dad with two daughters and a dog. Daytime, real job, you know, that a lot of us have. I'm a psychotherapist, mostly working on trauma-related stuff. Game design, you know, there's a few answers to that. I think I really, like a lot of people, the pandemic was kind of the inspiration to really work on something. I had the combination of having to, you know, stay at home and a newborn. And so a lot of interesting time on my hands. It's not exactly, you know, real time, like you have to take care of the child. But at the same time, it's really easy to do something like game design at the same time because they don't need much. Right beforehand, you know, I'd gotten deeper into board games and I had that first realization that people have, like, oh, you know, somebody actually thought of this, you know, thought beyond the game to the fact that somebody had to come up with this. For me, it was Mage Knight. And I was like, somebody actually came up with all this. That's amazing. And so I got interested in the idea of making my own game. Pandemic happened. I stumbled across a podcast, the Board Game Design Lab, and that Facebook group, and, you know, found some people on Discord, and TTS had just started up then. And I got in there and it was interesting. I connected and worked with people kind of around the world before I realized there were other designers right here in Syracuse. That happened many years later. That I was like, I'm not the only one. It is funny, but yeah, they're here, including like Alan Moon, right? So yeah, that was the way it started.
That's so funny to me because, yeah, now knowing a lot of you guys from Syracuse due to CuseCon, I can't imagine not realizing there in your backyard was this group you could hang out with, play board games that are published or prototypes.
Right. I didn't know Mike. I didn't know anybody at that point. And then, you know, slowly discovered it afterwards. And yeah, it's a pretty great little community we have here.
Oh, that's amazing. And so for anyone who doesn't know about, well, first your publishing company, maybe talk a little about that, but then Super Snipers, where did that inspiration come from?
Sure. I'll start with Super Snipers, I guess. So originally, I think the first thing that I wanted to do was create a hidden movement game. There was a few that I had played. I really liked them. I kept all the modern stuff I was playing. Wasn't quite as good as Scotland Yard, but Scotland Yard could be more exciting. And so that was really where I started, was this idea of like, oh, I want to make a hidden movement game. And then I had this concept. It's so far from what it actually is now, but, you know, of having kind of 3D terrain and having people have to describe how they viewed things. So I had this idea, I think I had the colors early on of the purple, gray, and gold, which I use now, that the buildings would be different colors and you would somehow have to relay, hey, this is, you know, I can see gold in this area, I can see purple over here, and you'd have to kind of deduce the different locations they could be in based on, you know, what they were seeing through their scope. That was way too complicated. and so like a lot of things, you know, what do you abstract? What do you gamify in a different way? And then I was thinking about, you know, okay, could we abstract that down to different see-through layers and you could kind of layer the buildings over each other. And then I realized that, hey, you know, polyominoes, Tetris pieces, you could kind of use these as a stand-in for the idea of, you know, focusing and putting your shop together. And so that was really the point at which the game as it is now really started being developed, when I came up with the idea of using Tetris pieces to stand in for the idea of the, you know, all the elements of, you know, locating, you know, targeting and honing in on a shot.
Yeah. Was this game always intended to be a 1-2 player game?
Yeah. So I'm really big on 2-player games and solo games. So that I really wanted a head-to-head experience. And it's also very important for me that people have something to play solo. Again, you know, kind of starting during the pandemic, I had one other person to play with and I had myself. And so that was it. And so for a long time, those were the games we played and I really got into. I've designed things outside of that box, but in terms of as a publishing company and primarily, yeah, I focus on 2-player and solo experiences.
Oh, that totally makes sense. I feel like a lot of people think of a larger player count and it's like, oh yeah, I buy this game and it's like a 2-4 player. But then they're like, but also I really just played at 2 players and it's not that great at that player count. And it's like, why did they do that? Should have just been 3-4. It's like this interesting thing versus someone who intentionally designs a game to be a 2-player.
Yes, I couldn't say it any better. And boy, have I run into that a lot. Those are the games that stick around is the ones that do play well at 2 players. Like, it's great to have those higher player counts, but primarily I'm playing games 2 players still to this day. That's primarily what gets played.
Oh God. Yeah. If I can find a game that plays like 2-8 players and it's actually good at those player counts, I am sold immediately because I have a tendency to over invite to game night, but also sometimes just have a one friend like staying over with me. So those are great. And I like that your games are quite compact too. So it's like easy to bring to like a board game cafe or I don't know, camping or wherever you play board games.
Yeah, definitely with a Minton specifically that I shifted to after this, that's a huge focus too, right? Is just, you don't have to think about it. Bring it along. Where are you? It doesn't matter. You can play it. You know, Super Snipers definitely takes a table, but still pretty compact. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with Super Snipers then, where did the like idea of the inspiration for it come from?
From a few different places. I love the idea of the sniper duel. I just think it's just a really fun head-to-head thing. And one of the things I like in head-to-head games, and one of the things I really wanted to capture with this was, you know, the feeling of pressure, which I think, you know, can both be a fun thing and can be a real turnoff for some people as well. And I've tried to accommodate both groups. So, you know, I really like the idea of the sniper duel and the pressure thing. And so that was a big part of it. In terms of the style of the game and kind of the world building, I got to give a lot of credit to the artist Wass Yang that I worked with. I would give him just the most basic instructions. I would give him, you know, a little bit of a background on a character, and I would give an idea like, hey, I'm really into, you know, all the games I used to play in the arcades in the 90s, kind of the art from Street Fighter and things like this, and I wanted the game to have an arcade feel. And he just translated that in ways that are 1,000 times better. I would have settled for so much less if, because I had no idea what was possible. There's a bit of a feedback loop there that as I started to see, you know, what he was able to do and color he added to that universe, it really inspired me as I branched out and expanded on it.
That's super cool. Yeah, looking at the box cover, it definitely feels very video game-esque. I could see that inspiration there. Like, I know the X is kind of meant to be more like, ooh, X marks the spot, going to make the shot, but also kind of feels like a PlayStation controller.
I like that. Yeah, okay, I'm looking at it as you say that, yeah.
I don't know if that was intentional, but I was like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Maybe. I'll have to ask Juan on that one. I definitely let him do the cover, so.
That's so cool. Talk to me how to play the game, going through step by step, how they're actually doing it beyond just, oh, you put polyominoes to figure out your scope.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way Super Snipers works, each player picks one of the 7 characters to be, which are going to give you, you know, some powers, which we'll talk about in a little bit, some asymmetric powers. But basically, the way the game works is everything's played until there are 3 kills, and each round ends in a kill, and each round has 3 phases. So the phases are hiding, locating, and targeting. And you can kind of imagine, you know, the middle of the table is where the hiding happens, and you work back towards your side of the table and then locate and then targeting. And so the way hiding works in the game, and I went through a lot of different variations on this, but where we landed, there's going to be 3 different what are called location grids. And so these are little 5x5 grids with a crosshair in the middle. You put them, 3 of them in front of you, and those represent like the 3 places that you know where your opponent might be hiding. You know that the sniper nest is in one of these 3 locations. And so the way you hide is you take these hiding discs, which have like on one side, they have a character's sigil. On the other, it either says miss or it shows their avatar. And you're putting these above your opponent's locations, right? And you're putting them face down. So it's a little bit, you know, some people have said it's like Battleship meets Tetris or something like that. But, you know, this idea that one of them is where I actually am, the one that has my avatar on the other side, and the other 2 I'm not. And so at that point, you've hidden. That's all there is to the hide phase. And then when you locate, the game from here on out is you're playing the polyomino. So I have the classic shapes from Tetris in there, right? And they come in three different colors. And there's something called your line of sight. So it's like the conveyor belt, again, in any modern Tetris. Like, you get to see the next pieces coming. So you're picking these up and you're playing them to any one of these little 5x5 grids. And your goal is just to isolate the crosshairs in the middle, right? So you're building a fence around it that isolates that, at which point you get to flip the disc and determine if you found them or not. So if you find them, you move on to the target phase. Otherwise, you keep going with the locate phase. I should say, all this time, these are simultaneous turns. So we're each playing a piece at a time and then, you know, resolving and then playing another piece. So at the point that you find your opponent, you're going to go to the target phase and you're going to target them at the same place that you located them. So basically, the locate grids each have a number on them. There's 1 through 3, and on the backs 4 through 6, because you can do different things to handicap players. You take the corresponding map. So then there's this grid. It's a, you know, it's an 8x8 map now on a PVC grid, and it pops into the scope board, which is a nice little dual layered board, so you can actually play the pieces against the edge. That's a big thing for me as I was playing other polyomino games, is I like to be able to play against an edge. But anyways, yeah. So now you're in the target phase, and now on your map, instead of just dealing with the crosshairs that you're trying to go around, you have innocent bystanders and you have your target. So you have to use your polyominoes to build fences around those innocent bystanders that to keep them away from the primary target. And you have to trap the primary target in what's called the kill box, which is just this 4x4 area in the center. You have to do all that, and you have to leave enough room for a special 3-square-shaped bullet polyomino to fit over them. And the first player to do that makes the kill for the round, and you set up for the next round. So those are the basics. That's the mile high view. There's more to it, but you know that's what you're doing each round.
And you mentioned asymmetric character powers. Want to go into that?
Yeah, sure. So when I made this, it wasn't my first design, but I was very, very young as a designer. But, you know, it definitely used the tried and true, you know, learn the rules of the game, and then every character breaks the rules in some fundamental way, right? So the way the powers work in the game is every character has a basic power. And like I said, they tend to be, again, I think I'd heard this from Eric Lang once, right? If everything is overpowered, nothing is, right? And so that was kind of the concept as something big. So for example, one of the characters is Gunhead. And so normally in the game, you can earn special bonuses by covering spaces that have with a matching color, right? There will be a bonus icon in purple. If you cover it in purple, you get to flip up that bonus on your scope board and you can use it later. And they'll do different things, like give you an extra piece you can exchange with, or allow you to move things around, or allow you to steal a piece. And so somebody like Gunhead, his power is simply, you know, once per target phase, just activate all those bonuses. So you could do that right in the beginning. So you have it right then, and then earn them again later and potentially use them twice, or vice versa. Earn them, use them, and then use them again. So he has the potential to use bonuses twice and nobody else does. And so they're all kind of like that, some sort of game breaking power. And then there's also very big on catch up mechanics. And we can certainly talk a lot about that in this game. But the round after you lose, you get a secondary power, your adrenaline power, which will give you one additional power that you can use during the game that helps you have a leg up the next round. So again, for example, with Gunhead, you know, when he has his adrenaline, it says when your opponent uses one of their bonuses, so those ones that I just talked about, you immediately draw a piece from the bag and place it right away. So it kind of puts you at a handicap or disincentivizes you from using your bonuses unless it's really going
to
help you.
Oh, I think that's a great way to look at doing those kinds of expandable characters. Like, I know that sometimes players that are new to games don't always love asymmetric abilities because it's hard to figure out, like, which one's better? How do I play this? And all that. I don't know if you do like a kind of a cheat sheet or anything on like who, if you're more defensive versus offensive, on which ones are better.
Post-game release, I put up on the website a lot of stuff and talked about, yeah, what are the easier ones? And I've certainly learned over doing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of teaches and conventions and things. You leave out the powers entirely the first round, you teach them all that stuff. Okay, now that you know everything, let's throw in this wrinkle. And, you know, looking back, I kind of wish I did that with the rule book. I struggled over that. The feedback went in a couple different directions. A lot of people saying that's completely not necessary, but you know, you do lose some people with the asymmetry, it's true, or you make it, you know, more challenging to have that good first experience.
No, I feel like that is definitely a you learn as you go kind of thing. So how long were you working on development changes, and like what kind of changes did you make beyond realizing like polyominoes, that's a good way to fix what I was, or not fix, but do what you wanted to do to give the feel with a mechanic?
Yeah, I certainly won't remember everything, and we wouldn't have time to talk about everything. Because again, you know, early days design, right? Like, you know, that key thing, once that was there, I feel like that was the heart of Super Snipers, but there were a lot of things that changed. So, you know, I still wanted to keep that hidden movement piece of it, which, you know, right now, as you can see, is you know, distilled down to this very small act of using your hiding disk and picking the location where you hide. Which does matter a little bit, by the way, because the different locations are different difficulties. So, and also, if you win on one, they go away. The next round, they're like compromised, right? Your opponent's heard the shot and they send people in to clear out the sniper nest or whatever thematically. So hiding at a harder location might get you the win, but you'll never be able to use it again. But stepping back, so, you know, the whole hidden movement aspect of it and the location, I went through a lot of different things. I had originally, for quite a while, had a system where I had like 6 cards that you could dedicate polyominoes to them. You didn't even have to do a puzzle there, but you did the right number and you'd flip over the card. And of course, one was them, but everything else was some sort of immediate effect. It wasn't a bad idea, you know, something like, okay, oh, you looked here. Well, guess what? Now I get to look in 2 places next time or something like that, or flip a card immediately. So I had that originally as the back and forth. Which of course I'm really happy I moved to the system I have now. And then I also originally had, even the targeting, I had more as a bust mechanic, where you would have to keep putting polyominoes in without covering up the innocent bystanders. That was originally the game, and whoever, you know, could keep going until, you know, the other person busted would be the winner. It was okay, but it didn't have quite the thematic connection. It felt a little weird. Like, well, why? You know, what's happening here that, you know, somebody is screwing up and the other person's getting the shot? And so moved from that to the idea of, you know, like, okay, actually doing something with this puzzle where I'm trying to isolate the innocent bystanders. I had a, you know, feedback about the whole bullet mechanic where you have to leave enough space. That ended up being, for taste, a really important one, just because it adds to the difficulty of the puzzle. It's a little easy to just isolate the innocents and just trap the primary target if that's all you're doing. But adding this little piece that you have to leave enough space for makes it really interesting. Those were all important pieces. I forget at what point I, you know, brought sand timers into it. And, you know, there's an option to play the game with simultaneous turns, like I said, where we just kind of wait for each other to finish our turns. And then there's a mode with sand timers where, as opposed to like actual, you know, it's not full real time, it's semi-real time in the sense that you start your turn by flipping this 10-second timer. And when you finish placing and that timer's up, you can start your next turn. So you can take more time if you want, but the other person might start getting ahead of you. So that was a major development. For me, that's the best way to play the game. It just adds that pressure, and it's a lot of fun, but it's not for everyone. I'm trying to think of other big changes that happen along the way.
I was going to say, for saying you don't have the memory, I'm like, you're just like, I'm like, all right, let's go.
No, those are probably the major ones. Yeah, in the beginning, there were no characters or character powers too, but, you know, I forget if I had in mind to do it. I certainly these days when I, you know, that's like the last thing to design because you're just going to have to keep changing them. Yeah.
I feel like when I design things, I'm like, all right, get the core down. And then all those like fun little tweaky things, I'm just like, we'll add that later. Someone wants asymmetric. Okay, we'll do that later. I want to make sure the core is good because typically those asymmetric or like extra cards tend to break it in other ways. So it's like, I want to get those like core rules down and make sure the play pattern's fun before I go messing with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, it will, and having the core down, I mean, really provides the direction of what would be interesting to do with those powers anyways. Yeah. Just a quick thing that was kind of, you know, funny as I designed. So it's fun. I've still got, you know, more expansion characters I'm making. And it's fun when you find like, where are the design spaces? Like, what are the things I can mess with? And one of the things that happened is, as I was, you know, turning this game into a product, you know, and thinking about different things, you know, talking with different people. So I think it might have been John Gilmore who actually was the first one who had said, so I'd originally had the maps, you know, where and they still do. They have spaces where you see the innocents are and where the primary target is, right? And he said, you should have meeples on there. People like seeing, you know, physical objects that they're going to start surrounding and everything like that. And so I did that, and it opened up the space like, oh, well, now here's something I can play with a player power. You know, now that these are removable, movable objects, maybe somebody can move them. Things like that happen along the way that help, guide what might be interesting. Anytime I had a component where I got feedback from people like, you know, this component isn't strictly necessary, I would make it necessary by giving a character a player power that used it. So
that was so fun. Did you find that you had any that you tried and were like, oh God, this is so bad?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, probably all of them until before their current version, right? It's really that whole, if everything's overpowered, nothing is, doesn't mean there still aren't things that are overpowered. So yeah, you know, yeah, there were certainly those and some that just weren't as fun or had to change. Cause you know, none that are sticking out too much right now.
I mean, that's good. That means you nailed it down. And your first instincts weren't terrible, which, I mean, I think the longer you do this, the better you get with shooting from the hip.
Absolutely. I mean, that's true with everything, right? Like, yeah, that's absolutely true. It's interesting. I'm not sure. I don't know what your you know, first design is or your first published game is, but there is also, like, I wouldn't say it's an advantage, but there's something to being ignorant and innocent, too. that just, like, opens up the creative world in a way that you might not happen anymore. I can't say that for sure, but you know, I was ignorant of other Polyomino games when I first started doing this. I played them before I finished it, you know, and it did influence, and I figured it out. And I, you know, I do that all the time now. If I'm making something, I play other things in the genre and I try to make sure I know what's out there. But that ignorance helped me kind of create something that's pretty unique. So
I agree with you in the way that it's good to research and try other games in the genre, but sometimes when you don't know, you create something that just hasn't even been explored because you're thinking about it in a very different way because you don't have all this like prior information to kind of bias you. And how did you decide to go with more like, hey, here's two shooters and these are buildings versus, and like having pedestrians versus like, I'm in a forest and there are animals, or you know what I mean? Like you could have gone with different environmental choices for the theme.
Yeah, I don't know. I love post-apocalyptic settings. They just do it for me for whatever reason. Every time I've taught this game and I introduce it, you know, the quick line, you know, you're super snipers, cybernetically and genetically enhanced super soldiers from the future, you know, the whole world is destroyed and blah, blah, blah. And it's now that we're done with that cheery thing. So yeah, it's, I'm not a dark person, but I just love those kind of post-apocalyptic urban landscape situations. And I think specifically for, you know, sniper duels too, you know, the setup is pretty sparse, but the idea is, you know, that we're working as mercenaries now and we're hired by different nomadic groups fighting over diminishing resources. So the city is the place, right? This is where we have to go.
Yeah. Do you feel like, because you mentioned you're not a dark person, do you feel like having this futuristic, not actually how the world is right now, makes it less dark?
That's an interesting question. So, you know, I will say this is one thing I typically say that my worlds of, you know, being a therapist and being a game designer are very different, but one way in which they aren't is like, it is so important to be able to play with things. It is so important to be able to laugh at things. It's so important to be able to make light of things. It's not the only thing you do. That's you know, it's not your way out of trauma, but it's a pretty important piece of it. I say that all the time. If I get a client that cannot laugh, I'm a little stuck. I don't, you know, if you don't have any way to play with it or any way to kind of like release it a little bit. So, you know, the kids I work with in inner city Syracuse who, you know, deal with, you know, shootings and stuff, they still play Call of Duty at the end of the day, right? And I know some people have issues with that or connect video games and board games in different ways with it. But for me, it's like, we like to play with the things that scare us or concern us or worry us. You know, we like to turn them into things that are a little bit more fun. So, you know, I know the theme is an absolute turnoff for people, for some people, right? Like they're just like, absolutely not, you know, game about guns. I'm not interested. And it's like, it's so arcadey. It's so cartoonish and it's so, you know, pushed into this other world that for me, it's just, it's fun. It makes light of something that, you know, is potentially a little bit heavy. Like, yeah, I'm scared about where the world's actually going.
I mean, I read a ton of those post-apocalyptic books. And honestly, I still read some of the like teen ones where I'm like, you know what? Who cares? It's nice to kind of think about like, well, the world kind of sucks right now, but it could be worse. I could be in the Hunger Games right now. I think it's also, it is something kind of you mentioned, like, I also have a psych background, and so it's interesting to, like, look at games and how people have social interactions and how certain things can be triggering or not triggering for a person, but, like, having the chance to, like, explore it. Like, I know in party games, that especially, something like Cards Against Humanity can be really funny to one person or really triggering to another, depending on the card content. And so, like, having that background is gotta be interesting and, like, helpful for your game design. Do you feel like that helps?
You know, I get asked that a lot, and I never have a great answer, but I you know, as we're talking about now, I guess so, a little bit. You know, I don't connect the worlds in any kind of deep way. I've never thought, well, you know, I should take that back. You know, in terms of a game designer, like, I design games I want to play, and that typically has very little to do with therapy.
Fair. I mean, it's your therapy. There you go.
Yeah, very, exactly. Well, right. It, you know, that's true. You know, it is part of my, you know, when I talk about self-care, it's like, it's nice. You know, I talk about game design all the time. I refer to it as brain candy, right? I can just roll this over in my head all day long and be perfectly happy. And it's nice to have somewhere to just go to when you need to go somewhere mm-hmm. in your head, you know?
Yeah.
And game design and music are both the same way for me, right? I'm more than happy to go there. I think of it, although sometimes with everything, like post-Gen Con, I didn't think about games.
I just need a break.
But it finally happened. I hadn't had that happen yet, but yeah, that was just a bit too much. But when I worked in one of the schools for one of the years, I did run a Dungeons and Dragons therapy group for like eighth grade boys, and that was absolutely fascinating. Like, that was really cool. But I've never really thought about, you know, putting my own touch on that.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious because I've gone to, like, the Save Against Fear was this convention that had a lot of therapy also involved, and they had certain games that highlighted different parts of, like, hey, if you want to work on, like, cognitive stuff, if you want to work on, like, kids or trauma or blah, 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 like, they kind of had these suggested games that some were, like, very obviously, like, oh, no, duh, but some I was, like, really? And then I, like, thought more about it, and I was, like, oh, wow, that would help me, like, with my communication skills or, like, figuring out how I feel about a specific scenario or whatever. Or, like, I just also, like, passively learning, like, outside of therapy, like, history. I love when a game is teaching me something about a really niche piece of history I probably would have never known about because I'm not someone who, like, picks up an encyclopedia or just, like, randomly looks out for whatever happened in, like, Switzerland during some time period. I don't know.
Or you just never run across it. At GAM, I played a game. Chris Chan had a game about, like, I think it was like a 1930s, and I forget when it was, but it was like a textiles strike.
Yeah, he told me about that. I haven't played it, but he did tell me about it, and I was like, oh, I do want to play it though. Yeah,
I learned a lot. Yeah.
No, I love that designers are starting to explore those kinds of pieces of history and deciding to, like, cut it out and be like, hey, we're gonna try this and see if people like it or find it interesting. Okay, well, here, so, like, you self-published. Tell me more about that. Like, what made you decide to go that route and also name it after you?
Yeah. So, why did I decide to go that route? Ignorance. No.
Ooh, was it this?
No, I'm happy now. I'm still doing it. I could choose to stop. No, I'm very happy I went through with it. But it's one of those things you just have no idea what you're getting in for. At least I didn't. But anyways, the big thing for me was... Right, so I was designing this game. I was actually, and then there was a game crafter contest coming up called it was for the solo duo contest. And, you know, games that I play at one or two players. Gabe from Board Game Design Lab was running it. And so I was like, okay, I'm gonna get this together for that. You know, that's good motivation to see what it's like to actually finish a game. Very luckily, Was Yang, who is the artist for the game, also a game designer, does really cool stuff. He's out in Malaysia. He had just put out a post there. He said, hey, you know, if anybody wants to collaborate for this contest, I'm happy to do, like, free graphic design and art. And I was so happy I hit him up because it was going to look, you know, it was going to look terrible. It's going to play okay, but oh my God, you know, right? And so we collaborated on this. And so, you know, two things happened. One, I started to see it as like, oh, this could be like an actual, like, game on somebody's shelf. Like, mm-hmm. There's that thing that happens, like, oh.
Where you're like, this is a product. It's not just an idea that I scratched down on some paper.
It's a product. And then I kind of, a bit last minute, I was preparing it for that solo duo contest. But in the meantime, I learned about the Cardboard Edison. And so I submitted it for that. I might have been like the first person to ever do a TTS video for their demo video too, but because I didn't have it physically at that point, but it did exist online. And so I ended up being a finalist in that contest in the Cardboard Edison for 2021. I was one of the finalists. And that was like that first spark of like, hey, maybe I know what I'm doing. maybe there's something to it. And from there, I was still thinking about pitching. But to this day, like, you know, bless you people who can do it. I don't know why I find pitching the harder hill to climb, as hard as this is.
Oh, it's not always mentally great for you.
It's just so hard to do.
Yeah. They both have different forms of difficulties associated with the paths.
Absolutely. You know, and you can, right, there are pros and cons of both. And I think, you know, I think the thing that happened was the way I put it is I fell in love with my vision for what this game was going to be. And I just decided that I had to see it through. And I also had, you know, and again, the ignorance part of it is like, and how hard can it be, right? I see these Kickstarters like, okay, you know, so you need some money, but otherwise, you know, what's to it? But yeah, so so I really just, it started out as a, you know, that thing that I'd heard, you know, like, don't start a business just to make your game, right? Like, start a business because you want to run a business. And I ignored that. I just wanted to make my game, and it turned into a business, and it's turned into something I really love. Galen's Games, I don't know, I mean, it's just me, so and it had that nice alliteration. Just,
you heard here, not hiring. Just me.
I am not at that point right now. I'd love to hire somebody to do the marketing logistics stuff. Oh my god.
Oh yeah, I am so not a fan of logistics. This is my least favorite part of everything involved with games.
Yeah, I'm going through, you know, getting towards fulfillment on the current one right now. Everything's in and starting to go out, and so stress, it's always a lot of stuff. But yeah, you know, I learned the hard way. If anybody listening is interested, I did also write a blog starting at about 3 months before the Kickstarter, all the way through, and quite a bit post, where I just real time, real numbers, you know, real experiences. Yeah, it's one of those, you know, read the blog not to learn what to do, but, you know, what not to do. And what you're not, what the questions you're not asking yourself and the things you're not thinking about. And I made a lot of friends from that blog. And a lot of people have found that really useful, just because it's not written from the benefit of experience. It's not written from looking back. And there are those kind of like real in the moment things. Anybody who's ever run a Kickstarter, if you read the one about the launch day, you'll be like, oh yeah, I remember every one of those feelings of watching that number go up, and you know that, oh yeah, it's crazy. But
yeah, no, the one and only time I tried to do a Kickstarter because I thought self-publishing was the right choice in the very beginning, I remember watching it and I was like, oh god, because I had read everything where it's like, if you don't fund in the first 2 days, it's not gonna fund. Like, that was like my fear, and I was so close. But then I decided, like, I don't want to run a business. I just enjoy designing games. And then I didn't go through with it, and I canceled it, and I never re-put it up. So that game will never come out.
And from where we're sitting, it looks like a good choice for you, right? Like, you're doing okay as a designer.
I'm doing okay. But at the time, I'm just like, I'm a failure. Like, I made this game, and I, like, hired a real artist. And I was just like, no one knew who I was. And it was the kind of game that shouldn't even be on a Kickstarter. Like, it's one I should have just self-published a small amount and, like, gone to, I don't know, little festivals or, like, local places, you know, and sold. Like, it wasn't bad. It just wasn't right for Kickstarter. It was so new. I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah. Those are the learning experiences, right? Like,
totally.
And your heart does get invested in it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, and there is a, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that goes on with that. And knowing psychology does not make you not a victim to it, right? And, like, that constantly refreshing that number. And it's funny, you know, one of the things I tell people is, in real life, you know, like, 18, 20, 25 bucks, it doesn't actually mean all that much to me. Like, you know, like, I don't care if my, you know, my investments do really well or really poorly all that much. I can kind of tune that out. But when you're on a Kickstarter, somebody spending 8 to 12 bucks, you're on top of the world, right? And somebody canceling for 8 or 12 bucks, and your heart's in your shoes, like, just... You know, it's like, you just, it's so bad. I don't know why it catches you so much, but
yeah, I don't know. but it's definitely, it's a different kind of rush.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, right? There are obviously good things too. There are these little summits you reach, right? Like you fund, the first time you get something from a manufacturer, the first time you see other people like, you know, playing your game and it's actually the game. And yeah, there's all sorts of stuff.
Do you have like a specific favorite experience?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question. There's a couple that come up, I think. Early on, it was at QSCon, and you know the family gamers, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay. So I had met Anitra and Ash, and I had talked to them, you know, just briefly about the game I had and everything, and Ash had expressed an interest in it. And he had played it, and he loved it. And the next day, as I was walking in, like, as I was, you know, checking in at the counter, I felt this tug on my arm, and it was him. He's like, I want to play again.
Aww.
And
I was like... I love their kids. They're so fun.
Yeah. And I was like, that was really cool. That was really neat. I definitely, you know, seeing the photos of people putting when the games arrived, that was really cool. And like watching it played on the table, getting BGG reviews, getting the Dice Tower seal of approval was a really big one too. When Tom liked it, that was huge. So yeah.
It's so funny. We always talk about the Dice Tower where it's like, for someone to not like a game on the Dice Tower, it's like, oh, well, that's unfortunate. But for someone to act like it, it's just like, oh my God, yeah, I got this thing and I can put it on my box now. And it's like so funny to me. I'm like, oh, wow. Because like, if they don't like it, they're like, oh, the Dice Tower is always like blah, blah, blah. But as soon as someone likes it, it's like, oh, way to go. Congratulations. And like, I'm so confused by this, but sure.
Yeah, it was kind of equally fun. It was just interesting because he had mentioned during the review that his daughters really liked it, and they did their top 10 of the year, and I made both of their top 10s, which
wow.
was really cool.
That is super cool.
It was neat. I was number one on one of them. It was really neat. I was like, yes, this is great. That felt validating too, you know.
That's so funny. He forced his kids onto his review of Caution Science, and they were so awkward. You could tell that they're like, I don't want to be here. And I was like, and then the end was a good review. Like, the numbers are good, but the whole video was like, it was so cringy. I just hated every moment of it. I was like, this has just been a bag and not a video. Oh man. And did you have like a least favorite experience more on the design development side than, I mean, because logistics, blah.
Nothing's popping up for me right now. I definitely had some rough moments in self-publishing, and those stand out, but not necessarily with the design side of things. I think you eventually get to a point where the game is done and what people are suggesting would be different, but not better. And so it was, well, I recognize that now, but during it, there were moments where the game was very much done, where some doubt creeped in, where people would have suggestions. And it was honestly just a matter of playtesting those suggestions and realizing what I had was better. But in those brief moments, like, oh shit, I didn't do it. The game's not as good as it could be. It's very scary.
I mean, that's probably why people do second and third editions, because they're like, the most playtesting you're going to get is when the product's actually out and people are playing it. But yeah. And how long did it take from that initial inspiration to it being published and people playing it?
Yeah, so I would have come up with the idea late 2019, kickstarted in 2022, and delivered in July of 24. So, you know, yeah, around 4 or 5 years, I guess, to actually have it out in the world.
That's exciting. I would say from all my interviews, it seems like 3 years is probably like kind of the norm-ish, but also when you're self-publishing, that adds a lot more. And when it's like your newer ones too.
There's this saying in the music business where you have, you know, you have your whole life to make your first album, and then you have 6 months to make your second.
Yeah,
album.
Yeah, totally.
Like, now you did it. Now you gotta, you know, produce again. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah, I always kind of wondered that too. If it's like with each game, it goes faster because you understand the process more. I'm not sure, but yeah. And what was your biggest takeaway from this experience of the game?
Yeah, good question. I think it's okay to you know, tread somewhere different, that it's quite, you know, you still have to make it fun, you still have to make it accessible. You want enough familiar in there that people, you know, can kind of find their way in. But you know, it was really validating overall, just to like, hey, you know, I had a good idea, it turned into a good game. People, like, you know, it wasn't hugely successful or anything like that, but you know, who knows, that story might not be all the way written either. So,
oh, totally. I mean, especially as a newer solo publisher, I mean, you don't have the same marketing money that Hasbro has.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, no. And I mean, the hook of a battleship meets Tetris is really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, my 2 seconds when I'm at conventions is always, you know, Tetris to the death. That's, you know, that's the quickest way I can describe
what
it.
What a tagline.
Yeah, and it usually, you know, it'll either turn people off or they'll come over and check it out.
Yeah, no, I think that would get me because I am a huge fan of Tetris. I'd be like, what does this mean? And how long does it take to play? And do you have any other projects that people should be looking out for? I know you mentioned a Kickstarter kind of fulfilling.
Yeah, so last November, wrapped up a Kickstarter for four new Mintin games. So these are all 1 to 2 player Mintin games. The whole kind of selling point is, you know, learn in 5 minutes, play in 20 minutes, play in anywhere. So there's four games. Happy to have people check that out. You know, they're fulfilling now, but they're going to be available more widely very soon. And then I've got, I don't have anything up for it except for a mailing list, but I have a next, I'm going to again do a series of four Mintin games. So I've got another four. I was showing them off at First Exposure in Gen Con. Bunch of two-player Mintin games. That's the direction I've gone now. Everything about Mintin games is easier, and I love it. I'm not saying I won't do another big box again, but I'm happy here for now.
That's awesome. And I mean, not everyone has those, so it's like a nice little niche that only a few publishers are currently doing.
Yeah, I seem to catch a good wave with that. It seems to be very popular. So, you know, that was the experience too with the Kickstarter is I spent half as much, but I got twice as much money and twice as many backers. So that's a good trajectory.
That's some good math. Right? Yeah. Like, I'm not a math guy, but that's some good math.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome. And then I guess for my last question, completely unrelated to everything we've been talking about, if you could have been the designer of any game, which game would you have picked?
I guess I'll say Mage Knight, just because that's the one I hold in the highest esteem. I think it's just the most beautiful work of design, and so I'd be more than happy to be associated with that.
But hey, you magically become the designer, so congratulations. So great job.
That would be the one. Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it.
All the hard work. No, I'm just kidding. Oh man. Well, thank you to everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 127, Super Snipers. And Galen, it's always fun to talk to you. I'm glad we've gotten to know each other over the years. But for anyone who's interested in checking out like that blog that you mentioned or the Kickstarter that's fulfilling, like where can you be reached?
Yeah, so I have a website, galensgames.com is the easiest place to go.
Perfect. And I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds, and trying to find me on social media, I can be found on Instagram and Blue Sky under Token Gamer, spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R. And then also I've mentioned it in the past few episodes, but I kicked off a short form video, tips and tricks, as well as like kind of these unboxing things, but more like a minute long, on Instagram and TikTok under Game Design Unboxed. We also have a website, so for sure check it out, gamedesignunboxed.com. But thank you so much for being on the show, and I'm sure I'll catch in a little bit, even though I guess when this airs, it'll be in the past at QsCon.
See you at QsCon, yeah.
See ya.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.